Well, hey, everybody, welcome to I Don't Care with me, Kevin Stevenson. Great to have you with us today. Today's guest is my good friend, John Carter, and I'm going to let him explain all of this, but John is the brand ambassador for Pinnacle Healthcare Consulting. John, first of all, welcome to I Don't Care. Second of all, what the heck does that mean?
Absolutely, Kevin. Well, thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here. Excited for the conversation. So brand ambassador for Pinnacle is a really fancy, nice title. And what it really means is it carries a lot of responsibility. So within Pinnacle, we have five companies in the umbrella. So my role as brand ambassador is really twofold, internally facing and external facing as well. Internally, it is really championing the enterprise vision across our family of companies. So systems, processes, workflows, really helping to integrate all of the different silos, much like healthcare is siloed. Some of our experts are experts in their space, but how do we create a common operating picture that allows us to support our clients along their strategy continuum, flexing resources where needed, advising where not, plugging in on those projects to really keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on in healthcare and really helping strengthen our teams. One of the unique things I get to do is create bespoke solutions for some of our large national clients. So really pulling resources from multiple teams across multiple companies to package it together and support the need of the client. Externally, it is all things marketing and branding. That includes our social media. That includes our thought leadership. That includes our conferences and attending those conferences, not only to cultivate meaningful relationships as a trusted advisor and connecting our experts with client needs, but also for education to keep my sword sharp and to keep my finger on the pulse of everything that's going on in healthcare and all of our different realms to really help understand not only challenges and how we can support our clients, but also how we can take those best practices from across the nation, share them with our internal team, and use them for further resource to advance not only our own initiatives, but those strategic objectives of our clients. So it's a really fun job. It's something that my ADD loves because I'm working on 20 different projects at any given time. It also means that it comes from every direction at all hours of the day, but I wouldn't trade it for the world. Very happy to actually be a part of Pinnacle and to get to do all the fun things they allow me to do.
That's great. Yeah. You know, you and I are kind of cut from the same cloth, and it's the same thing with me here in my position. There, you know, multiple projects coming from everywhere. And yeah, we started talking about this almost 2 years ago now. You being on the podcast when I was at, we saw each other at ACHE Congress back in, I think it was March of 23. So it's about time you made it on the show. So you and I both, we spent some time on the dark side, on the accountable care organization, value-based care side. So when we were talking about doing this, I love the idea. You know, let's talk a little bit about the evolution of value-based care and where, you know, kind of where it began and where it is today and where you think and see that it's going in the future.
Yeah, if you want to look at where it began, healthcare, the pendulum is always swinging. So go back to the 90s, dust off your notes, and just call it a strategic refresh 2.0. That's probably the best approach. I do think the HMO models probably caught a lot of flack because they didn't put the patient first. Mm-hmm. And I think it really did kind of come down to a race to the bottom. And sometimes I think value-based care gets a bad rap for that. I think a lot of people look at it as a race to the bottom, and there's most certainly some challenges in value-based care. I think it's really been interesting across my career. I always tell people I've just been very, very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time. I transitioned out of the military. So I was in the Army for 14 years. And mm-hmm. What drew me to healthcare is really the same thing that drew me to the Army. It's service above self. I'm not a clinician. I don't have the skill sets. I don't have the acumen. I don't have the academic background, but I do have the heart to serve. And I think one of the places that I have found that you can really leverage those skill sets is in healthcare. It's a complex adaptive system that requires agile and adaptive leadership. And so as I got into healthcare, I realized for me to really understand the operating environment, I needed to do two things. I needed to follow the money And I needed to get my finger on the pulse of the providers, because that's where everything happens, right? Without physicians, our hospitals are big empty hotel rooms. And so I just happened to be working with hospitals and health systems across the country when the model changed out from underneath us. We passed the Affordable Care Act. Fast forward to 2015, we repealed the sustainable growth rates. We implemented MACRA, and I think that's when things really started to accelerate. So we started to see value-based care shortly after the Affordable Care Act, right around 2012 is when it started to take off. In fact, my colleague that oversees our value-based care team here at Pinnacle started the first ACO in the country. She's ACO 1001 at Palm Beach ACO in Florida. She then went on to Allidade, was employee number 567, somewhere in there. I'm sure we're all familiar with Allidade. Had tremendous success, wanted to see if she could do it in the hospital and health system setting. Had tremendous success there and now works with us. That's actually one of the teams I work most closely with, building ACOs, optimizing ACOs, and really shaping the future of what I think healthcare is going to be. So that evolution took us through a rampant period of, you know, I remember when we were working with physicians and recruiting doctors with income guarantees. Now they're very much employed and integrated into large physician enterprises. Of course, unique models from corporate practice of medicine in California, specifically here in Texas, we have it as well under the foundational model. Those models started to really take off. I think that was the catalyst that started us down the train, or should say the train down the tracks, and really led us to a evolution of multiple different models. So you've seen accountable care organizations, you've seen patient-centered medical homes, comprehensive primary care initiative, primary care first, direct contracting models. A lot of work that you all have probably seen in the hospital is the BPCI model, right? So bundle payment for care improvement, comprehensive joint replacement, Medicare shared savings. All of those different models, I think, were really designed to test and experiment what it was going to take for healthcare to be successful. When I look at the evolution of value-based care, I kind of look at the risk continuum. So I look at how did we get from fee-for-service to quality incentives to performance-based contracts or pay for performance into shared savings. So MSSP, next-gen models, bundled payments, shared risk, partial capitation, right? So think of the ACO REACH models. Think of some of the new models that are coming out, all the way to total capitation. There's a new model coming out called the AHEAD model that actually is just now starting, which is an all-payer health equity model. It's a total cost of care model. It's going to be commercial and private insurers that are going to be working to control total cost of care, as you'd imagine. Maryland is one of the test grounds there. I think Vermont is also going to be doing it as well. So I think the takeaway of where we are and probably more so where we're going is within CMMI. So I was at a conference recently where Liz Fowler, the director of CMMI, said, you know, we are doubling down 100% on Medicare lives in an accountable arrangement by 2030. And to give context to that 2030 number, I don't think sometimes people realize where that number came from. So just a quick step back, the baby boomer generation are those that are between 1946 and 1964. You add 65 years to 1964, that gets you to 2029. So by 2030, the entire baby boomer generation will be in the Medicare age bracket.
Right.
That's
right.
Where the number came from.
Yeah.
She said, you know, it is a marathon. It's not a sprint. Come to find out, it's an ultra marathon. We're in this for the long haul. But I think that what you're finding is creative ways to test models to really move the needle forward in value-based care. Trying to balance predictability with the regulatory and statutory environment, right? So we kind of go back to MACRA. You look at MIPS, or alternative payment models. MIPS by 2022, I think, 2022. Yeah, so by 2022, we hit the plus or minus 9%, which is budget neutral, right? Sometimes we're robbing Peter to pay Paul. So all of that to say, we continue to test new models. We continue to move the needle. We have to find a way to get away from acute episodic care into preventative whole person care. Yeah. That, I think, is the evolution. I think that is the push. And that's really where we are today, testing all of these different models. I most certainly have some theories on where we're going, but today I think it is taking the best application of all of these models and trying to figure out what works to create an environment where people are more comfortable taking on risk.
Yeah. Well, and you know, John, I mean, you're talking about the evolution and where we are today in that preventative care model, you know, trying to encourage the patient to assume some level of risk, that's a question that we've all, you know, faced for a number of years now. Now, what are your thoughts in and around that? How can healthcare providers educate that patient to, you know, say, look, you know, hey, we're in Texas. I know you love your chicken fried steak and your barbecue, but how do you balance that with your health? And so what are your thoughts in and around that?
Yeah, I think it's a challenge. It's always going to be a challenge, right? Mm-hmm. When it comes to patient adherence, there's always going to be wins. There's always going to be losses. You know, my good friend Scott Hurst, I think, was mm-hmm. recently on your podcast as well.
He was.
I thought he made some very valid points that we really have to get upstream to the employers. The employers have to get involved. We have to understand what it's going to cost these employers, what it's going to take to work with these payers. And I also think that we have to make a strong push towards preventative care. So when you look at some of these plans, right, a lot of taking on the risk from, and I'm not here to give favors to any of the payers, although I do work with some, but I've also spent a lot of time on the provider side, and I've had many of the same fights that our organizations are fighting. But what I will say is, you know, I think Christian was on your podcast as well, another good friend, who said that, that the payers are frankly tired of the cost shifting, right? And so mm-hmm. part of passing on the risk is also taking ownership of the programs. So the wellness programs, finding resources for behavioral health, finding all of the things that we need for diabetes, for obesity, for smoking cessation, all of these things that are going to create healthier outcomes. I think right now what we've seen in value-based care, at least in the evolution, is a beginning of we worked on the process. So we were rewarding the process, and now we're seeing a shift to we're rewarding the outcomes. We are moving to an era where you're going to see no outcomes, no income, right? And so the three-legged stool is the providers, it is the payers, and it is the patient. And I think that all three of them need to take responsibility. Now, if you solve the conundrum of patient engagement and adherence, I think you would be a miracle worker. But you have to do the best with what you have. And I think the more you show that you care and the more that you're invested in those patients, the more you're going to see an increase in those quality outcomes. And I think the other point, again, that Scott made is we've got to start early. Value-based care to me is planting a seed for a tree whose shade we will never sit. We are shaping the future of what our children and our grandchildren's healthcare will look like. And that means we need to start with our children, right? We need to start with pediatrics, and we need to find ways to incentivize healthy eating, incentivize healthy options within schools, incentivize programs that reward the things that are going to stave off long-term chronic care, chronic conditions.
Yeah. Well, and we have seen, you know, that when the employers do draw a line in the sand, we've seen it work. You know, many employers have the, you know, the smoking, the non-smoking pledge, and the healthcare premium incentives are in and around that. And sometimes penalties too, for those more forward thinking, employers. We've seen the same thing with, the in and around, you know, where you can earn points mm-hmm. to, you know, basically pay down your premium through a wellness center, you know, STEP programs, you name it, you know. So it does work, you know, but you have to be, as you said, you've got to be diligent about it, and you do have to start really early. You know, my kids are early 30s and late 20s, and their employers are doing things like this. You know, they're both in companies that are pretty young, you know, geared more towards younger employees. And so there are programs that they're involved in that, good grief, 35, 40 years ago when I entered the workforce, we'd never even think about. So I think you're right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think we have a long way to go. And it looks like I may have froze. I apologize. But looks like we've got a long way to go. But I think that's inevitably where we have to go. You know, we're rapidly approaching 20% GDP. We saw mm-hmm. we saw it come down, but that's also because, you know, frankly, some of the dollars went up in terms of what we put into the economy. But we've got to do something to curb the cost. And what way do we do that and still provide quality healthcare? I think is really the biggest challenge. You know, one of the initiatives that we're working diligently on is the integration of specialists into mm-hmm. value-based care. I think what we've done is we've done a good job in the primary care market. We have shown that, you know, there is opportunity in delayed gratification if you do the work. And not only do you see the outcomes improve, but, you know, mm-hmm. 18 months from now, you're going to see the rewards from that labor. In the specialty care, it's been really hard to tackle. And so, you know, CMMI, again, has pushed out two recent articles about their strategic refresh that focus on integration of specialty care. It also mm-hmm. focuses on sharing of data. So they're going to be sharing data on specialists in your market, in that specialty, that are going to help ACOs make informed decisions and have stronger conversations with specialists outside of what we've seen as the stereotypical shadow bundles, right?
Yeah.
It's really about creating a network where they're incentivized to take on some of that risk. Some of the other mechanisms that we're seeing that are going to help support that is the legislation that's come out in terms of value-based enterprises. And mm-hmm. some of the opportunities within the no risk, moderate risk, and full risk categories for care coordination, which I think is one of the big pushes right now. You know, yesterday there was a great article in Modern Healthcare about the team model that is a mandatory bundled payment model. So again, we're going this direction. I think the real challenge, and this is probably something you wrestle with every day in the hospital setting, is it's hard to be successful with one foot in the fee-for-service bucket and one foot in the value-based care bucket. So how do you do it? My response in the work that we do would be in the world of margin compression, what options do you have? It's not like reimbursement is going to spring back, right? And so you have to find a way to start moving in that direction on the value-based care side. But if you do it correctly, I think it's a way to optimize the system because you're providing quality care, improved outcomes, which generate shared savings on one side. So a high margin, high EBITDA return. And on the other side, you're freeing up capacity from a constrained environment where you have limited resources. Our hospitals are resource constrained and capacity constrained. We just don't have enough physicians. And as our population ages, they need more access to specialty care. So if we're working in both sides correctly, we're creating capacity on one side that maximizes and optimizes good fee for service and provides good quality care by getting the right patient, the right intervention at the right time. And we probably need to look at alternative models where our specialists are not providing a lot of the primary care services, right? So, you know, cardiologists, you know, doing a lot of PCP visits versus being in the cath lab, orthos doing the E&M visits when they'd rather be in the OR. So how do we work on both sides to optimize the entire model that A, holds the business, right, mm-hmm. in a position that we're not continually operating at negative margins, or at least finding opportunities to diversify our revenue streams, and B, doing well while doing good.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that topic because, you know, I read an article last week, you know, as we baby boomers continue to age, we are 1.4 million physicians in the hole. Yeah, and so we've got to look at how can we broaden that level of access. I got a couple of stories, and you know, that go right along with what you just said. You know, cardiology doing primary care, and God bless them. I mean, we see cardiologists now that are, you know, trying to impact their patients. You know, A1C, they're trying to do everything else. But that, as you said, that's pulling them out of the cath lab. You know, they're having to pick up that slack in the dearth of primary care. And so that's one area that I've seen personally. And number two, I see this not only in the physician associations, but also, you know, love nurses, but the nurses like to do what falls within their scope of practice, and that has become it's become a burden on many, because you know, you hear stories on a regular basis of, you know, 6, 8, 10 week times to get an appointment in a specialist office because they don't have a mid-level provider that's in there, you know, doing clinic. You know, and so the physicians have to do it. So we've got to continue to solve that issue, you know, allow more, a broader scope for mid-levels to be able to do kind of the basic stuff, you know, that, that physicians back, you know, 50, 60 years ago, even 20 years ago, used to do on a routine basis.
Yeah, on the specialty side, you're continuing to see subspecialization, and so you know, yeah. if you go to your ortho spine, they're not wanting to take any general case, right? I would say we have to optimize the model in a team based environment, and that does not I'm not advocating for scope creep, but what I am saying is that we have to allow our practitioners to operate the top of their licensure,
right?
And they have to know how to move someone into another category or get another provider or physician involved when they've reached that limit. But I think that that team-based care is frankly one of the reasons that we've been able to stave off to some degree the challenges that are continuing to come, because you're absolutely right. When you look at the physician workforce, if I look at family medicine and I look at internal medicine, let's say there's roughly 90 to 100,000 in each, that's a good number. But when I look at my specialty care, I look at the dwindling number of urologists. I look at the dwindling number of GIs. I look at the dwindling number of nephrology, cardiology, ortho. The list goes on. When there's roughly 18,000 orthos in the country, there's just not enough there to provide service. So you start to see that backlog. And so one, we've got to do a better job of, again, working in value-based care to optimize outcomes. And two, streamlining the fee-for-service side within the hospital so that we create capacity to treat those patients and get timely interventions when they're needed. And that's why I think as a healthcare ecosystem, we have to look at it holistically. I'm not saying that fee-for-service is going to go away anytime soon. There's a lot of momentum behind it. It's really hard to change the chassis that our system's been tied to for so long, right? We're trying to move the Titanic, not a skiff. But I think that the outpatient side will see capitation much more quickly than we will see in the hospital environment. And so, again, how do you navigate both sides of that fence to create better outcomes? Going back to the no outcome, no income, there's been a lot of talk about primary care providers and specifically primary care physicians being the quarterback of healthcare. I am not necessarily a fan of that analogy. I know a lot of people are, but I think it's more realistic that they're point guards. I think when you think of it from a quarterback perspective, you throw the ball and the receiver is the specialist. It doesn't come back. You don't know. You don't know what happened, right? And so from a point guard perspective, the ball should always be coming back to the primary care to coordinate all of those services. And we need to reward them for the work that they do. And that's the hard part on a work RVU perspective, right? Is that high revenue generating specialists generate more work RVUs. And so it becomes a challenge in the entire ecosystem of how do we manage it financially. But I know that we're going to continue down this path and it's only going to get harder. And so we have to figure out how do we maximize both sides to ensure that we create continuity and stability for our communities and that we're providing the right care for the right patient at the right time, because frankly, that's our mission. That's why we chose healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. And your point guard analogy is dead on, because, in your quarterback model, yeah, that specialist gets out there and then they start taking over and scope creep happens. But if it's fed back into the primary care physician, then there is so much better care coordination across the board. You know, we run into all the time, you know, and even in my own family, you know, I'm at the age, I got multiple specialists now, right? And so everybody's prescribing something. And then you go to your primary care doc and they're like, I didn't know you were on this. And, you know, and so, you know, if you've got that one point guard that's taking care of that, you know, all of your care, then that coordination is so much better.
Yeah, that's
great. Hey, you know, in the few minutes we've got left, let's talk a little bit about something else, you know, that there are, you know, places like Walmart and some other large organizations are doing, you know, funneling specific surgeries, specific procedures to centers of excellence. Let's talk a little bit about that, because that gets real controversial.
You know, it's interesting. When you brought that up, I didn't think we were taking a left. I thought we were taking a right, and you were going to talk about how these retailers have failed epically in primary care. But, you know, even within our IPA, right? So I used to run network operations for a large IPA with 650 plus physicians across 250 practices, neurosurgery to pediatrics. Those employers, Walmart being one of them, came to us and said, you've got groups within your organization that meet the criteria for centers of excellence. And, you know, I think what they have found is that that's where we're going. As a country, that's where we're going. And I, you know, it is controversial, but if they have found that we're going to get a better outcome if we spend the money for our patient to leave our state to go to another state to put them up, travel expenses included, to get the procedure and come back because we know they have a higher quality, lower cost, and lower risk of readmission, that's probably telling. And I think that what you're finding is that's where we're going. In fact, this is a great segue, not just in centers of excellence, but when I talk about CMMI and sharing data and all of the things that are coming down the pike, we're finding that a lot of these models have developed because it's been so hard to bridge the gap between specialty care and primary care in a value-based care arrangement. So what's happened is PMPM dollars that were going to primary care providers under the Medicare Shared Savings or your ACO model or whatever program you were in have been carved out. If you look at what's happening after the Cures Act, and now nephrologists are taking attribution and doing a wonderful job, right, in terms of managing that population, managing those patients. But those are PMPM dollars that are going to them under the chronic care, the CKCC model, right? If you look at the GUIDE model, which is coming out for guiding an improved experience in dementia patients, you're going to see probably some neurologists that are going to be taking some of that PMPM. If you look at the enhanced oncology model, where you have oncologists that are taking full capitated risk for cancer patients, that's PMPM dollars, right? And so what's happening is the dollars are being carved out and shifted over to the specialist, which to our earlier point is a bit of a challenge because there's not enough capacity constraints. So how do we bridge the gap to bring them back together? And that's some of the work that we're seeing in value-based enterprises, care coordination, risk arrangements. Not to say that we're there yet, but in a perfect world, you could create a subcap network of specialists that would take on that risk and then be rewarded for the shared risk that they take on in part of that arrangement. And I think that's the evolution behind CMMI's strategic refresh to engage specialists and share data. That's where we're going. How do we get there?
Okay, very good. Hey, John, it's been great not only to see you and talk to you, but you brought some great insights to the show. Any last words in our last couple of minutes?
Kevin, it's always a pleasure to be with you. I love catching up. Hopefully next time it's in person over some coffee, but this has been a phenomenal experience. Appreciate the time. And certainly if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to continue the conversation or connect them with some of the experts on our team. My email is jcarter@askphc. So jcarter@askphc.com.
Great. Thanks for that. John Carter, brand ambassador for Pinnacle Healthcare Consulting. Thanks again for joining me today on I Don't Care with me, Kevin Stevenson. And you, audience, I appreciate you as always. I know you've got other avenues of education and entertainment. I'm just glad you chose I Don't Care for that choice today. So with that, we will see you next week. Take care.